that are going on. Now that we've done the sacrament of holy announcements, let's pray. Father, tonight as we delve into the Word of God, we pray that your Holy Spirit would come into this place and into this time and direct and guide our conversation. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our God, our rock, and our Redeemer, and all God's saints said, amen. All right, friends, let's do one more thing with regard to the preliminaries, and then we'll dive into the book of Exodus real quick. As you probably figured out about me some time ago, I tend to take the Bible at face value. I know there are people who don't. What I consider to be a metaphor is a metaphor. I mean, not because I consider it to be a metaphor, but I mean, that's just kind of how I look at it. And what I consider to be a recording of something historical, I consider it to be a recording of something historical. And I believe that that's what we have in, when we were in Genesis, remember we talked about, well, what is Genesis chapter 1? I mean, what is that? I mean, what's going on there? I mean, if there's nobody there, who's writing all this down, you know? I mean, if a tree falls, if a, not going to say that. What's going on there? So we can have a discussion about this. But what we have clearly here, it begins with something interesting. What does it begin with? Exodus. Anybody know right off the top of their head? Exodus chapter 1? No, Exodus. Exodus chapter 1. It's a curveball there. Yeah, it begins in Egypt, but it begins with... Oh, what? The descendants, yes, a bowling trophy for you. The descendants of Jacob, they're all right there. All this is a genealogy, and as I've told you before, genealogies are not put there to put you to sleep. Genealogies are there to let you know, to alert you of something. You are being provided the web of context, the context of history, because these are individuals, and they're saying this person and this person and this person, and you are getting back to a certain historical point. As I said, the place is thick with Norwegians, I think, tonight. Is that not true? How many of you can trace your ancestry back to some place in Norway? Any of you can? Oh, gosh, the sea of hands go up. Absolutely. Well, I'm not suggesting that you are all telling a fairy story about that. I believe that you actually can do that. And the reason why you do that is because you're interested in your heritage. You're interested in your family and the stories that go along with that. Some of you have some fun family stories. Does anybody have any fun family stories about how your ancestors got to this country? I do. In a boat. Yeah, they came in a boat. Most of them did. The planes were full. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, the... Yes, the British had all the planes. My ancestors, the cross ancestors, there were three brothers that the British kindly asked to leave Ireland. They were naughty. Yes, indeed. As the Irish tend to be towards the British, and they were asked kindly to leave or suffer the consequences. And so one came to South Africa, one went to South Africa, one went to Australia, and one came to America with a guy who would later become the territorial governor of Montana, of all crazy things, you know, just sort of nutty things like that. So that's kind of one crazy story that I know about my ancestors kind of back there. The Swedish ancestors, they came here, the girl came because, well, she came because girls come for certain reasons like that. You know how that works. Keep it quiet. No one's supposed to know except a few thousand of our friends, you know? That's how that happens. The Germans came here because they knew they could get rich, so that's why. Just saying, that's why they came. The genealogy is to help tell us how we got to a place as well. And I've said to you before in the Bible, where are you and how did you get there are two of the most important questions you can ask. So, where are they? They're in Egypt. Okay, how did they get there?
By foot.
By foot. Homer Trophy for you. Homer Trophy for you, sorry. Okay, yes. How did they get there? Well, because, first of all, we have this case of intrigue. And again, as I said before, the book of Exodus is not a separate literary unit. It requires that you know the other story of Genesis. It just does. It's not just floating around out there like somebody wrote a novel and here it is and here's my novel. No, it requires that you know what was going on in Genesis. And what went on in Genesis that was a rotten thing? Joseph, yes, Joseph was the rotten thing. Joseph's stinking brothers sold Joseph into slavery, and then it backfired on them, and then God said, okay, well, I'll make it all good. And so then, because of the famine, Joseph's brothers, their children, and Joseph's father all come to Egypt. And Pharaoh, thinks this is a great deal because, you know, Joseph has been, I'm of the opinion that if one double heath medium blizzard is good, 12 must be better, right? I mean, is not that a fair assessment? That if one is good, 12 must be better. It's starting to show that 12 must be better. But in any case, that was his thinking. If one guy like this, if one of these Hebrews has prospered me in the way that this one Hebrew has prospered me, and he is the runt of the litter, just think of how much I'm going to be prospered by his more prosperous brothers and father, who he says all kinds of kind things about. Well, his father, his brothers not so much. So that must be his thinking. And so Pharaoh embraces these people warmly, and it's all good. Well, it's all good for a while. Let's read on. Keith, are you there yet? You're there. Read 1:1. Exodus 1:1. We all there?
These are the names of the.
Is that all?
These are the names.
Mm-hmm.
Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan, and Naphtali.
Naphtali, that'll work, yeah.
Gad and Asher.
Mm-hmm.
All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons.
70 people.
Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them.
Okay, here is the first situation that we see. They grew, they did what? They notice some words there that are familiar to you? Multiply?
Fruitful.
Where have you heard be fruitful and multiply before? In the garden, absolutely, at the very beginning. You heard this concept of to be fruitful and multiply. So what we see is God's plan starting to unfold. God's plan is unfolding, and God's plan is starting to really kick in gear. We also are getting hints of the idea that, okay, God had told Abraham that that his descendants will be as the sand of the sea and the stars of the sky. So we're starting to see this happen. So God's plan is starting to unfold. Do you know what happens when God's plan starts to unfold? What? The devil's not far from not far away. Guess what? When God's plan starts to get off the ground, my dad was, of course, you know, the sergeant. He was in North Africa and with a fighter bomber group, and he said, Paul, there's two times that make it easy to shoot down one of these fighter planes. It's tough to shoot them down when they're in the sky because they're very maneuverable, but when they're taking off and when they're landing, it's very easy to shoot them down. He says it's very, very easy because they're on a very specific trajectory, and guess what? All you got to do is aim in front of that trajectory, and they get shot down. So God's plan's about ready to take off. So guess what? Guess what? Here's what. Read the next passage.
Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph.
There arose a new king over Egypt and who not knew not Joseph. So here's the problem. There's somebody who has completely forgotten the prosperity that Egypt had been blessed with under Joseph. He had no concept of it. And what does he turn around and see? All these Irishmen around here. What are all these Irishmen doing here, for crying out loud? We need to put up posters that said, no Irish need apply. Oh, do you think that xenophobia and bigotry is something new to this country and new to our people? Of course, we have almost an inbred fear of foreigners. That's what xenophobia means, by the way. We have this inbred fear of foreigners. We have this, we love to scapegoat them. I mean, what do you think's going on right now, friends? I mean, come on. That's what's happening, and people feel that, and people fear that, and people have this anxiety. Well, they did then too. The place is awash with these Hebrews. Because you couldn't call them Jews, by the way. Remember, we've been through that? They're not Jews, are they? Why are they not Jews? Remember, anybody remember? Because they're not all descendants of Judah. Yeah, that Judah has you know, besides, the idea of Judaism hasn't even formed yet. The idea of Israel hasn't even formed yet. It's about ready to form. This is about where Israel is going to become, instead of a clan or a sort of tribe, it's going to become a nation. But that's what it's happening here, but not yet. But they're not Jews yet, because the Jewish nation won't be born until after the exile, which is going to take place almost 1,000 years later from this point in time, or about that. We don't know exactly. So, okay? But we got a problem. And the spiritual thing that I think that we can learn from this, I mean, kind of for our takeaway, is that when God is doing something new in our lives, or God's doing something good in our lives, we can expect spiritual pushback. It's just that simple. And we need to just get our heads around the fact that that's what happens, is that when God's doing something that's really going to happen, we can expect the enemy of our souls to fight us on it. And we should not be surprised. I mean, it doesn't mean we can't, well, I shouldn't, let me rephrase that. It's always surprising, it's always disconcerting, but after you kind of sit back and say, aha, then it should come to us and realize that, yes, that's what's been going on. God was, you're really kind of getting some traction here. So we have the problem. Okay, now, well, let's read on a little bit here. Keep going.
And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us.
Now, I don't know why that having a mathematical operation should be against the law. I mean, it's just simple arithmetic, and why simple arithmetic should be against... I'm sorry, I'm just keep going.
Fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, let us set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They build for Pharaoh... store cities, Pithom and Ramses, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so there we have the predicament. Now, let's throw it in reverse a little bit here just for a second. So we've got a picture of what's going on. Now, what is going on is God's plan is about to unfold in a very major way, even after a period of about 400 years. Now, we've got a historical place, right? Egypt is a historical place, we know that. We have a people who are the Hebrews. We understand that there are a people that are sort of a kind of a... Well, let me put it to you like this, what they're like. The word Hebrew is very much debated as to what it means. What does the word Hebrew mean? As best as we can tell, and there are a lot of different ways of trying to understand this, and there are a lot of different contenders to what the word Hebrew means. As best as we can figure it, it means one who crosses over. From the Semitic languages for which Hebrew is based on, it's one who crosses over. So the idea is that these people were likely nomads. And when we think of nomads, we think of people who are not particularly wealthy. This, of course, would be one of our great misunderstandings, because Abraham was, after all, not rich. He was stinking rich. I mean, he had prospered tremendously. Now, as a nomadic people, here are a couple things that are pluses for being nomadic. When times get tough, you can pick up and move on. Do you know why that is? Because you live in a tent. My favorite mnemonic device for living in a tent. The Hebrew word for tent is ohel. Ohel. And I always remember, like, ohel, I live in a tent. There are no cognates from Hebrew into English at all. Behemoth is the only one. So you had to come up with, well, remember Beersheba? It was the well of seven. So I'm going to go out and get me a seven pack, get a Beersheba, a seven pack. So that's how one. But oh hell, I live in it. But that you can pick up and move the tent wherever you want to move it, right? That's an advantage, okay? If you're living in a civilized area, you know, I just bought a wonderful home here in Fargo. It's beautiful and it's brick. There's one problem about brick things, though. I mean, you know, if the big bad wolf comes along, it's tall cotton, friends. We're in good shape, right? But if it comes time that I need to move that brick home, I'm going to have problems. I'm going to have serious problems, because it's heavy and it's not elastic and it doesn't want to pick up and move. And guess what? The Egyptians built things out of brick, for crying out loud. So they were heavy and they didn't move too much. So that was part of the problem. You couldn't just pick this thing up and move it around and so that. But these nomadic folks that you could come in and they could do all right. Now, the Egyptians saw nomadic people as a threat, because they could just pick up and move along, and they used them as to take care of their herds for a while. But then after that, they said, well, what are we going to do here? So we've got that problem right there. So we've got a nomadic people. Another problem about nomadic people is this. Not only can you pick up and move on, you typically don't have the kind of, well, you know, I ultimately grew up in Washington, D.C., there's not a lot to commend Washington, D.C. It's hot in the summertime and humid. As a matter of fact, it's so hot and humid in July and August that only tomatoes and politicians can live there. But it's insufferable traffic, incredibly self-important people. I mean, all the self-important people of the United States move there. It's just true. And it's just kind of the nature. There are very few redeeming qualities of Washington, D.C., except one. The monuments. They're beautiful. I mean, they're absolutely beautiful. They inspire patriotism in us. I mean, no monument inspires more patriotism in me than the Jefferson Memorial. I like the Lincoln Memorial, okay, but the Jefferson Memorial is kind of my all-time favorite. Do you have any favorite memorial? Anybody ever been to Washington and have other memorials that are their favorites? What's your favorite, Sandy?
All of them, but anyway, I love Arlington.
Arlington Cemetery, yes, indeed. That's where Sergeant Cross is laid to rest. Also, Rhonda's father is laid to rest in Arlington. Rhonda's grandfather is laid to rest there. Her grandmother's laid to rest there. My mother will be buried there. My mother-in-law will be buried. It's our family cemetery. Only problem is we can't be buried there, so that's kind of a funny thing about our family cemetery. But I mean, yes, you go there and it's awe-inspiring. You go into Lee's Mansion, it's awe-inspiring. It reminds us of our history. Any other favorites? The Washington Memorial, this big obelisk. Where do you think we got the idea of making a big obelisk from? Anybody got any ideas? The Egyptians, exactly. They're the ones who made these giant obelisks. Big ones, not quite as big as that one, 555 feet. No building in Washington, D.C. can even be close to that height. It's illegal for that to happen. But this beautiful obelisk as a memorial to George Washington. As we used to say growing up, First in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. You had to be there when the Senators were there. Then they came to Minnesota and were the Twins, and then they become, yeah, exactly. And then they actually start winning, for crying out loud. I'm not bitter, no. But in any case, we have these memorials, and you remember stuff to the memorials. Nomadic people do not have that. And here's the problem. This is the problem of the book of Exodus, is that you have a group of nomadic people, and this is their story. This is the story told from the nomadic people's perspective, and then you have an oppressor people who have all the memorials. And so the critical scholars ask, where on earth do we find the story of the Exodus? And you will find people. We're going to have later on, maybe next month, we're going to have a special showing of a movie called Pattern of Evidence that I want you to see. And it will deal with all the issues regarding the dating of Exodus, because there are a lot of problems. I'm not going to say that there are not problems with the dating of Exodus. Exodus is a tough girl to take out. The dating of Exodus is really challenging for a couple of reasons. There's nothing in the record of Egypt to indicate that anything like the Exodus happened. Or I shouldn't say nothing, it's hard to find. But that shouldn't be surprising. Who would build a memorial to your defeat? Okay, who would build a memorial to your defeat? Nobody would do that. No one would build a memorial to, especially a humiliating defeat, and especially at the hand of somebody who was obviously in a weaker and lesser position. No one would build that such a memorial. So that's one problem. Another problem has to do with the occupation of the Hebrew people into the area of Palestine. Now, I'm not saying that these are insurmountable problems, but this is an issue that needs to be addressed, and I love how this movie addresses some of those things. Plus, the archaeological record of this area. There's a lot of people that are making this exodus, and where are their footsteps, I guess, is the question that people often ask. So we're going to look at all those questions, and we will answer them, hopefully, by looking at this movie. This guy does a much better job of it than I did. But let me give you an about time. They're really, for people who embrace the idea of the Exodus really happening, there are two timelines. There's the traditional timeline, and then there's what's called the critical timeline. The traditional timeline suggests that this all happened somewhere in around 1500 BC. And interestingly enough, what we have written here looks very much like 1500 BC in what we do know of that time. It means that somewhere around 1400 BC, Israel is starting to occupy the Promised Land. Okay? Now, the other timeline is somewhere around 1200 BC, 1250 BC, and that Israel's starting to occupy the Promised Land in the 1100s BC. Somewhere in there is the truth. As I said, this is written as a historical, and it has a very historical perspective to it. But we shouldn't be bothered by the fact that there's not a lot of evidence for it. That shouldn't bother us, again, largely because we're dealing with nomads. Nomads were kind of like Boy Scouts. You know what the motto of Boy Scouts are, don't you, when they camp nowadays? Be prepared, that's their motto. Leave no trace. When I was a Boy Scout, we didn't call it that, but we did do that. But now, when my son Ian was in Boy Scouts, that was a big deal. Make sure that you don't leave anything behind that would indicate that you were there. And that kind of makes sense, because if you are a nomadic people, you really don't want people following you. It shouldn't surprise us or bother us that there's not a lot of what we would call hardcore archaeological evidence that about this event. We have this document that makes an immense amount of sense, however. So, is that any questions about that or any thoughts about that particular aspect of things? Yes, Robert.
Would all Israelites be descendants
Would all Israelites be descendants of Abraham, except those that have been adopted in? Yes. Yes, all Israelites would be descendants of Abraham.
So would all Hebrews be Israelites?
No! No, that's the interesting thing. Are all, just as not all Israelites are Jews. See, this is kind of crazy. You see, it starts, Abraham is called Abraham the Hebrew. Now, Hebrew is almost kind of like a dirty name. It's almost kind of like a curse word, a derogatory comment, because when you see, we've already talked about this before, when Potiphar's wife, she says, you brought this Hebrew in here. I mean, you can feel the bigotry in that statement when she says that. But, you know, there comes a point when people own that, and where their bigotry, where other people's bigotry towards them with pride, that happens from time to time and place to place. As I pointed out to you before, the name Lutheran is like that. Lutheran was a derogatory term used by the Roman Church at the time, and it was seen as, this is, you know, someone, a follower of Luther, not Christ, until finally people took it on and wore it with pride. Maybe a little bit too much pride, but that's okay. That's just another story. They would be Hebrews, yes. But see, but now we're going to be making a switch, though. Here at this point in time, we will be switching, and they'll still be, every now and then, like for example, you will see, say for example, in 1 Samuel, the Philistines call them Hebrews as well. Typically, the people who call this group of people Hebrews are outsiders. This is an outsider's name for them, okay? Again, it's not a nice thing to call them. Oh, they're not calling them Israelites or the sons of Abraham or anything like that. No, they're calling them a bunch of stinking Hebrews. It's derogatory, but they embrace it. Again, kind of interesting that way. So, and isn't that way sometimes when people scorn us and look at us in a derogatory manner? Sometimes we just take on that. Okay? All right. Yes, Ernie. Some Israelites that didn't make the trip. You know, I wasn't there. I wasn't keeping, but probably not. Let's face it, you've got famine going on here. And you have a very patriarchal culture. So you do what your dad says. Yeah. Imagine that. Boy, there's a culture to live in, to do where dad says. Holy cow. What a novel idea about that. So you do what your dad says. And because, as you will recall, they're living kind of in the central highlands of Israel, and the other people around there, they have long memories. You will recall what happened at Shechem, where they decided that you shouldn't be messing with our sister this way. And so, if you want to become like us, you all need to get circumcised. And just when they were in their greatest pain, they wiped them all out. So, you know, the likelihood, it wouldn't be a good idea to stay behind. So the answer is, my guess is they all left. Yes?
What's the estimated time, number of years between the death of Joseph and Moses coming and taking him out?
Again, we don't know exactly. Typically, the number is 400 years. I mean, that's the number that's said there. Now, you need to understand something, as I've said to you many times before. The Hebrew Bible is not a math book. It's a very math, again, they use 3 for pi. Those of you who are engineers know how inaccurate that would be and the problems that you would have if you used the number 3 for pi. You would have a serious problem on your hands because that 0.14 and however far out it goes, it matters. I mean, don't tell me that it doesn't matter. It does matter. So that's one thing. The other thing is that anytime you see a round number, and a round number beginning with 4 and at least 1 0 behind it, you should go, because there may be something there that's an indication of something else. As I've said to you before, in a nomadic culture, you're not going to be expecting them to use scientific measurements to say, but they're going to be trying to describe things. For example, the 10 generations that were before the flood and the 10 generations that were after the flood. Well, what are they trying to say? Are they trying to say that there were exactly 10 generations before and after the flood? By the way, do you know how many years were in a generation?
40,
exactly. That was a round number. Now, see, 10 times 40 is what? 400! Holy cow! It's 400! So, you know, and what does that mean?
A long time.
A long stinking time. A really long time ago. Some of you who are the real genealogical jocks might be able to go back 6, 7 generations. Going back 10 generations, you're in rarefied air, friends. I got a feature for you. I know my mom did this sort of stuff. She did it for a long time. The best she could do was go back to 1632, and then my father said, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to conceive. Anyway. The clan of 70.
Were they in Goshen?
Yes, that's where they... Well, Goshen, they were in... Okay, when we think of Egypt, it's a big piece of real estate. It's a big piece of real estate with a lot of nothing. A lot of nothing. You have this very, very, very narrow strip along the Nile upon which either side they irrigate. Then when you get to the delta, you have a lot of fertile ground there. There's only one problem with the delta. The folks in Seguin say this, only a Yankee, only they wouldn't say Yankee, they'd say something else about a Yankee. Only a Yankee, they have an inseparable prefix for Yankees, by the way, down there, just in case you're wondering. But only a Yankee would build their house where the pecan trees grow naturally. Have you ever seen a pecan nut? They're big. How do you think they got there? Lots and lots and lots and lots of water. An annual flood. They're in the pecan bottoms, in the floodplain. Yeah, they're pretty right now, but wait till one of the, you know, maybe 20-year floods come along. That place is going to be a mess. The same is true about deltas. Deltas are wonderful places to have agriculture. Why is that? Because it floods a lot there. And, you know, so while at first blush it might look like a good deal, at second blush it's not such a great thing. Indeed. In any case, so that's what's going on here. Okay, any other questions about what's going on now? Shall we proceed? Okay, let's proceed into the meat of the matter. Okay, what we have here at the very beginning of the book of Exodus, hang on, let me get to the spot in my notes that says what we have here at the beginning of we have three predicaments that unfold before us. Predicament number one, God's people are in bondage. Pick it up where you were. Verse 12, right?
So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves.
Wasn't a single Ruth in the bunch.
And made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves.
Again.
Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named, is it Shiphrah?
Mm-hmm.
And the other, Puah?
I love that name. How come we don't name our daughters Shiphrah and Puah? I mean, really, you know, there is this big tendency for now to come up with innovative names and biblical innovative. Why not Shiphrah and Puah, for crying out loud? These are good women. Come on, I challenge you, those of childbearing time, and you name some kids Shiphrah and Puah.
When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill it, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" And the midwives said to Pharaoh, Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous.
Vigorous!
And give birth before the midwife comes to them.
This is a wonderful word here. I just have to stop here. This is one of my favorite passages. Did you know that in, those of you who come from a German background, know that there are two types of eating in German, right? There's Essen and Fressen. Essen is what we do. What Fressens? Animals fressen, of course, and so I'm going to get killed for sure, but I did not say this. I mean, it's in the book. The Hebrew here is an indication. There's a way that humans give birth, and there's a way that animals give birth, and this is the Hebrew women. They're just animals. They're just sort of out in the field, you know, 8.5 months pregnant, and plop out comes another baby. Just kind of like, that's kind of the picture that you're getting here. And that's what the Hebrew midwives are telling Pharaoh, saying these women are just animals, and we just can't stop them. We this is just how it is. Again, a very graphic story. And if you're, again, sitting around the campfire telling this story in the Hebrew, at this point, people start laughing because they think this is kind of funny, because on the one hand, it's just a funny idea, and on the other hand, Pharaoh is obviously having the wool pulled over his eyes. Here's this sharp guy, and here are these two midwives pulling the wool over the eyes of Pharaoh. Okay, read on.
So God dealt well with the midwives.
Yes.
People multiplied and grew very strong.
Yes.
And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile.
Mine.
But you shall let every daughter live.
Okay.
Now a man from the house of Levi went and took his...
No, stop. Okay, first we must deal with predicament number one. Predicament number one is the predicament of Israel. The predicament of Israel is that we have some prerequisite knowledge here. We have to know who Israel is. We already talked about that. How they got to Egypt, we talked about that. Who is Joseph? Why is his? What's significant about his death? And what's the connection of Genesis? We got that all the way through. But part one of the predicament is this. The descendants are prospering, as I said, and people are getting ticked off. The redundancy of the mention of Israel's prosperity shows us that God is prospering these people no matter what. In spite of the opposition that they're facing, God is prospering them. And I think this is something that's important for us to understand. That God is in the abundance business. God wants to prosper us. God wants us to have... sometimes it's hard to see that when we're being persecuted, because sometimes prosperity and persecution look awfully similar. Look awfully similar. But nevertheless, that's what's going on, because over and over again, it says, doesn't seem... No matter what Pharaoh does, he can't stop the people of Israel from procreating and prospering, because, as I said back before, this is all predicated not just of the story of Joseph, but it's also predicated upon the beginning of Genesis, that we see God's plan unfolding in a major way. Okay? This is what's called the history of God's salvation, or salvation history, some people call this. It is a historical story. It's actually happening, but what the history is, what's being described, like, for example, how we tell the story of the manifest destiny of America. The folks that came here before our parents came here have a different view of that. One of my favorite T-shirts of all time is a picture of, what's the guy's name again? The Apache guy. Geronimo. It's a picture of Geronimo on his horse, and it says, Homeland Security since 1492. it's a different telling of history. It's the same events, but it's a different lens. The salvation history is talking about the events that are going on, and sometimes people might be oblivious to what God's hand is doing in history, but this is a story of history as seen through the lens of what is God doing in this historical event. How's God's hand at work in this? And so we see this unfolding here, okay? So there is this prosperity that's linked both to Genesis 1 and the latter part of Genesis with the telling of Joseph's story. Okay, then the predicament part 2 is that Pharaoh's ignorance of Joseph. The fact that Joseph was a touchstone to God's acts in the past is, and how he did, is a big problem. God was particularly blessing the people of Egypt through Joseph, but now we've got someone who doesn't know anything about it. And remember that Joseph was a type of the Messiah. Now, predicament part 3 of this is that Pharaoh was afraid of it. They're too many, they're too mighty. He's worried that they'll still get even bigger. Now, what's interesting is this. There is a little piece of history here that we do know, that we do corroborate. There are folks called the Hyksos. And we do know that at one time, there was this foreign group of people that came into Egypt and kind of took over. We don't know a lot about them, but we do know that about somewhere, you know, in this time, within a couple hundred years, these people did indeed exist and did indeed possess. They possessed an outside threat. By making words up. I guess there are not enough words to make. They posed an outside threat to Egypt. Okay? So we know that. So this is what Pharaoh's worried about, that these guys are going to hook up. I mean, I'm sure none of us are worried about a fifth column today. You know what a fifth column is? It's people living here that might pose a threat to our national security because they might indeed be in league with our enemies. Nobody here is worried about that, are they? Curious. Well, this is what Pharaoh was worried about. We got all these foreigners here. They're going to cause problems for us. They might hook up with the Hyksos, or worse yet, don't they speak that their Semitic language just like the Hittites do? Well, of course they do. They're a Semitic people, and the Hittites were among Egypt's national rivals, I mean, in the regional area. So we have this idea that Pharaoh thinks this is not a good thing. So we got that going on. So that's the part of the predicament. Then we have probably the most comical and the most sad part of it, and that is Pharaoh's solution to Israel's prosperity, and that is to slaughter the male children. Now, Pharaoh is basically stupid. Let me tell you why Pharaoh's stupid. Without getting into the nuts and bolts of the matter, but if you want to commit genocide, it's not the males that you have to worry about. As I said, you know, if one male slips through and you've got lots and lots of females, well, you know, you're not going to have a very effective genocide program going on, right? You can have all the males in the world and yet one or two females, and guess what? You're not going to be procreating a lot, okay? So his problem is that he thinks that he can do away with them by getting rid of the males. This is a very dumb idea and kind of shows how ignorant he was in the whole process of committing genocide. Not that we want to take up a class on how to commit genocide or anything like that, but again, he could teach one on how not to do it because he does a pretty bad job of it. I've mentioned already that that they give birth like animals, but they also did something else. These two Hebrew midwives, it says what about them? Did anybody catch what it said about them? They feared God. And again, we had a sermon series that mentioned the fear of God in here earlier this summer and what the fear of God is. They had a healthy respect for who God was, what God could do, and so they said, you know, I would much rather stand before God than stand before Pharaoh. And so, I mean, in terms of, I'm not worried about Pharaoh. I'm more worried about what God would have to say about this. So I'm going to side with God on this one. So I'm going to come up with whatever I need to come up with and say, you know, it's not happening. Sorry, Pharaoh. It's just not working. And so that's what's going on. And yes. Sure. Now, you put me in a difficult spot here. Right now, you probably asked probably one of the greatest questions of all. I would give you the bowling trophy of bowling trophies, except for the fact people would accuse me of nepotism. Absolutely. So that would be a problem. Okay, this is an important question. Rhonda's question was this. What did the religion of the Israelites look like at that time? This is a the Hebrews. What did it look like at this time? This is a very curious question because you only have an oral tradition. I mean, if we believe that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, guess what? Genesis wasn't written yet. Absolutely not written yet. So that's all that we could have would be an oral tradition of the stories of our patriarchs and matriarchs, because it is both. It's patriarchs and matriarchs together. That's all we would have. The other challenge, of course, to this is this, is that when Moses does show up on the scene, there is this big question like, okay, burning bush, who are you? Who am I going to tell these people that I'm here? There seems to be a very spotty memory of what God has done in the past. And so that the fact that the Hebrew midwives would have had fear for God would be an exceptional virtue on their part. Because it's very evident that the rest of the Hebrew people have somewhere along the line just become, you know, mainline Hebrews about things. You know, I mean, really, think about it. They've just sort of, you know, they checked the box. You know, do you have a religious affiliation? Yes, I'm Lutheran. I love this. This is it's changed dramatically. But when I started out as a pastor, this is kind of funny because I mean, if you'd asked my father what it is, he would have said he was Lutheran, even though he hadn't been to church in 40 years. Seriously, in the United States, there were a survey was done, and about 12 million people. This was in the mid 1980s. 12 million people said that they were Lutheran. The only problem is this: that you could only find about, even at best, you know, and you know how pastors keep records. You know, they want to pump up the rolls. About 8 million. Of all the Lutheran bodies. So there's about 4 million people running around on nobody's rolls saying they're Lutheran. How crazy is that? Now they don't bother. They don't even say anymore. They just, you know, if only they'd say. But it might be something like that, that faith to them and religion to them is only a distant memory of their parents and grandparents. But here is a story of two women who took it seriously. But it's a great question because, as I said, there's nothing written at this time. It's 100% oral at this time. It's sitting around the campfire. Remember I told you that a lot of this is sitting around the campfire? But again, just because it's sitting around the campfire doesn't mean it can't be repeated accurately. Remember what I told you? What were some of the ways that they repeated it accurately? Does anybody remember? Chiasms, yes. These incredible oral ways of telling a story so that you remember it exactly how it was told to you before. That it has parallels, 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 parallels until you get to the center, and that's the main, like the account of the ark. It's a chiasm that says, and God remembered Noah. And if God remembered Noah in tough times, God certainly will remember me in a hard time. And so that's really what the story of Genesis, it's a factual account, but seen through the eyes of faith, this is the main point, that God remembered me, or God remembered Noah at that time. And if God remembered Noah, God certainly could remember me in a difficult time. So that was one way. Then they had other literary means of poetic stuff, of telling things. And also, if you're in an oral culture, you tend to have a heightened sense of how you communicate, as opposed to relying upon something like this and going, using your thumbs, for crying out loud. For goodness sake, God gave you 10 digits, not two. Pity's sake, use them all. But that's kind of how it is. I mean, how is it that we communicate? And they can do it very effectively. So that's a great question. Probably the question of tonight, I mean, really, because what were they like? So, okay. So that's the predicament of Israel. We have a serious predicament on our hands. But wait, there's more. There's another predicament. There's predicament number two. Predicament number two is with chapter two. Why don't you go ahead and read?
Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman.
You notice neither of them are mentioned by name yet. We will learn that the man's name is Amram and the woman's name is Jochebed. And we're talking about Jochebed's problem right here. Okay, read on.
The woman conceived and bore a son.
That is what happens.
And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months.
Now I got a question to ask you, ladies, that have had children. Did any of you ever think, my, that's an ugly baby? None of you thought that. You know, often talk about UBS, ugly baby syndrome. I mean, you know, but no one's ever said that that child's an ugly child. Nobody ever. So why do we get the impression that Moses was a good-looking baby? Because his mother said so? What else was she going to say? Okay, read on.
When she could hide him no longer, she took him for a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch.
Yes.
And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him.
He's got a sister. That should pay attention.
Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. And while her young woman walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it.
Mm-hmm.
When she opened it, she saw the child.
Woo!
And behold, the baby was crying.
Imagine that.
She took pity.
You know, don't you love how in the movies this is portrayed? You know, the crocodiles, the hippopotamus are chomping at the basket and all sort of stuff. I love that. So, yeah.
She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children."
Okay.
Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for
mm-hmm.
you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And so the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water."
Now, contrary to the Ten Commandments, contrary to the Prince of Egypt, contrary to anything that you have ever thought about Moses and his upbringing, it was no secret that he was a Hebrew. Guess what? It says, "Oh gosh, Charlton Heston's sort of wondering, I didn't realize I was a Hebrew." No. Is that what it says here? What did it say here? He was around his family for a long time until he was weaned, and I'm not going to go into how long that might have been, because actually in those times it could have been a long time. And so he knew something else was up. And again, what's interesting, I think is fascinating, is that how did she know he was a Hebrew child? It was the blanket, of course. Absolutely, it was the blanket. Actually, I'm going to give you a hint. I think she might have lifted up the blanket. Oh my, the clippity clip. Yes, he's got the clippity clip, so therefore it's likely he's one of these Hebrews, because guess what? Some of you have not heard of the clippity clip. Those of you who have not heard of the clippity clip, we have two things in life. One is the clippity clip, which of course is circumcision, and then there's the snippity snip. The snippity snip sort of negates any prosperity or any future procreation that goes on in life. They didn't really practice the snippity snip unless they made the choppity chop, which was for eunuchs and so forth. And I'm just giving it, putting it language that people can understand. You've got the snippity snip, the clippity clip, the snippity snip, and the choppity chop. The choppity chop, you don't want the choppity chop, but believe me. But they practiced all of these things. Yeah, but it's likely that she lifted up the blanket. I mean, there is this blanket there. It says, "Aha! Something's missing here." So that's how they would have known. So that's my guess, as I said. Because here's the thing: if you read through the Bible, you'll find a couple instances where people, like the Romans in particular. Now, either the Romans are complete nitwits, which I doubt seriously, because they've had a fairly good way of conquering the world. The Romans frequently, and particularly in the case of Paul, mistake him for an Egyptian. Why is that? They look the same, if you're not paying attention. So, anyway. So I don't think it's an ethnic difference like some people have suggested. I think it is a cultural difference, and I think the cultural difference would most likely be the snippity-snip, because this is a sign that you are in covenant with God. And that's an important feature of how is it that we are readily identified as being in covenant with God. Okay? Read on.
One day when Moses...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're not done. I've got ahead of myself. Okay, number one. We have three women in this predicament with Jochebed here. Woman number one is Jochebed, even though we don't know that's her name. It says that she was a descendant of Levi, married to another descendant of Levi. Can anybody say kissing cousins? Very likely. She was the mother of at least three children. The oldest was Miriam. The next oldest was Aaron, and the youngest was Moses. Are any of you older sisters? What would any of you older sisters to younger brothers? Yes? What would your younger brother have to say about you? That you were kind and loving. You know, I don't doubt you. I suspect that you were very kind and loving.
We tied him to the clothesline pole.
Oh, wow. That sounds fairly typical, yes. But we did that. You didn't let anybody else do that, did you?
No.
No one else? Someone else did that?
My sister.
Yeah, but if it was somebody else, there'd be words, right? There'd have been words in town. There could have been, yes. We understand that. Those of us who are the younger brothers to older sisters know how older sisters can be. They can be very possessive of their baby, but also very tormenting of their baby, and they can be very bossy. But they love to play mom. They love to play mom, and that's what's going on here. Think of this, I mean, again, if we think that this is an actual story with actual people, we need to understand that they're actual. I remember a sermon about the image of God. Weren't any of you paying attention on Sunday? And one of the parts of the image of God was the psychological image of God, and that God created us as psychological beings, and therefore there's relationships, we're created relationally, and in these psychological relationships, there are certain relationships that have certain patterns to them. And guess what? You're going to see Miriam, her pattern of being the older sister, play out in the life of Moses. We're going to see this several episodes, particularly in Numbers, we're going to see that play out. But again, it's kind of interesting. Also in Exodus chapter 17, we're going to see it play out too. Okay, so we've got that going on. So that's she offers services, the services of her mother to nurse the child. And then thirdly, we have Pharaoh's daughter with her maids. The irony of Pharaoh's daughter being a person who rescued Moses. The greater irony of Pharaoh's daughter paying Moses' own mother to nurse the child. Wouldn't you say that's kind of ironic? That, of course, here you've got Pharaoh saying, let's wipe all these kids out, especially the male ones. Then you've got his daughter saving the child, and then his daughter paying the child's actual mother to mother the child. That's what I call God's sense of humor and God's prosperity. Okay? You don't want to mess with God's people and so forth, because all kinds of incredibly ironic things happen along the way. So that's predicament number two. Predicament number two is the predicament that Jochebed is in, because she's kind of in hot water because she has this baby, this illegal baby. And what does she do? She tries to protect the little baby by covering the baby. Do you remember the word cover throughout the book of Genesis? We cover ourselves. We cover the ark with what? The covering of Joseph with the coat. This idea of the covering. And here we have again this covering that's taking place that God's protection is over Moses in the river. So we have this concept that goes out, that there, that God has made a covering for us. And of course, did I mention the fact that the covering that God made for Adam and Eve from the skins of the animals after they had sinned? This concept of God's protection and covering, this theme is going to go throughout. And sometimes I think it's important for us to keep that in mind. I think if there's a message for us, is to remember that God's desire is to cover us and protect us, even in very difficult times, and that God is watching out for us. So I think we need to keep mindful of that in this particular setting, because it's not just simply a telling of a story, it's a telling of God's salvation, and a telling of God's salvation for which we can relate and which we can trust and which we can we can put our trust in. We can have confidence in God's word for our own circumstances like this. Okay, predicament number 3. Read on.
One day. When Moses had grown up.
He'd grown up.
He went outside to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down.
That's what you do, Ann. You look this way and that. You don't walk around and saunter like you're the prince of Egypt. You look this way, and you're I love this word. You're furtive about it. You're sneaky. Read on.
And seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand.
Now, why did he hide him in the sand? Wasn't he afraid the guy was going to get up out of the sand? He did what, Bonnie? He killed him. Now, wait a minute. That can't be right. Moses couldn't kill anybody. He's the lawgiver. Moses is the one that God chose to give us the Ten Commandments. And isn't that one of the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not kill. This can't be right. He obviously just pretending to have killed him, right? Just like Jesus pretended to pass out on the cross, but he actually wasn't dead, huh? No, dead means dead means dead means dead.
But he didn't have the Ten Commandments.
He didn't have the Ten Commandments. That's an interesting point that you make there. He didn't have the Ten Commandments. We did talk about this a little bit last week, this concept of natural law versus revealed law. Natural law is the stuff that we just know to be right, and we see in the world order that this is kind of how it is, and that the nature has revealed it to us that this shouldn't be this way. But revealed law is the word of God. God says, I make a special revelation here that says, this is how it is, and this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. This is how you order your community. This is how you treat other people. This is how you act in an ethical manner. Okay, so it becomes more specified so that there's clarity that's involved. But yes, Gail, bowling trophy for you that had not been codified yet. But that doesn't necessarily mean that murder was okay, because even in other societies, there were codes that said you shouldn't do such things. Yes. Yeah, exactly. He hid the body. He's looking this way and that. He knows that he's doing something very wrong. Yeah, he is not ignorant of the fact that he's doing something that he could get him a lot of trouble. Okay? Obviously, he's got a temper. Or what he's got is a sense of justice that is kind of at work here, but maybe it's a little bit misguided here. Okay. Well, not necessarily misguided, but he needs to understand what's going on. Read on.
When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? And he answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known.
Okay, here's an interesting thing here. Sometimes we insert ourselves to think that we can bring justice to a situation where no one has asked us to bring justice to that situation. And that is precisely what Moses has done. He has entered a situation to bring justice to a situation which nobody asked him to. And then the people with whom he thought he was bringing justice to, he says, well, what are you guys doing? The guy looks at him and says, what's it to you? Who made you a judge over me? It kind of backfires on him, doesn't it? And isn't that the way? Is that sometimes when we try to do things like that for other people, we realize they didn't ask us to do these things for them. And so therefore, what's the response? Well, the hole is dug deeper because then he realizes, oh, crap, we're in big trouble here. This is just not good. The thing is known. It's not like it's something that, you know, was hidden. It wasn't hidden at all. People know this. The word's out. I'm in trouble. And so what's he do? He goes, appeals to his brother Ramesses II and says, Ramesses, we're buddies. We grew up together. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a different story.
The fact that the Hebrew said, who made you a prince?
Yes.
They obviously knew who Moses was.
Exactly. Exactly. Who made you a prince? Precisely. This is the worst kept secret in Egypt. He says, who made you a prince?
So Moses probably didn't fit in because he didn't fit in with his own people because they see him as living in Egypt and the Egyptians.
They see him as a quisling, absolutely. You Norwegian types know what quislings are? Okay. Just curious. I'm just asking. So, yo! Quisling was the guy that in World War II, who was a Norwegian national, who basically let the Nazis in and turned the government over to the Nazis during World War II, and generally considered an internal traitor to one's own people. So, yeah. Yeah. So. Okay? All right. Yes. Great, great observation there. You're getting way too many bowling trophies tonight. People are going to suspect something. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Next, keep going.
When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses.
Yes, again, there's no royal privilege here, you know, not happening. Okay, read on.
But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well.
See, I thought it was because that Pharaoh, you know, was in love with this girl, and Moses was in love with the same girl, and then they got driven out of, that's again, different story. Okay.
Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters.
Wow!
And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock.
Mm-hmm. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
The shepherds came and drove them away.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
But Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us out.
A what?
An Egyptian.
Wait a second. Hold the phone here. I thought Pharaoh's daughter said he was a Hebrew. And why did they know? Clippity clip. Because you could do that to a little baby boy. But what's happening here?
Wardrobe.
Yeah, we have wardrobe. And actually, this is kind of this. Wardrobe plays a lot to do with this. It really does. Because how did the Samaritan woman know that Jesus was a Jew? Because of wardrobe. How he dressed. He probably had phylacteries, just like every other Jew did at the time. He probably had the typical dress that a rabbi might have on because of wardrobe. How did she guess that this guy was an Egyptian? Because what he was wearing. Not because what he looked like, or maybe how he had his hair, or something like that, but something stylish in that particular manner. Now, all right, read on.
They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and even drew water for us, and watered the flock.
Mm-hmm.
He said to his daughter, then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that we may eat bread. And Moses was content to dwell with the man.
I guess so. He's got seven daughters.
And he gave Moses' daughter Zipporah.
Well, why not? Yeah.
She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land.
Servant sounds like Hebrew for sojourner. So there you go. So here's Moses' predicament. He's got quite the predicament going on here. He murders a man. As you mentioned before, murder is not the first word that comes to your mind when you consider Moses. But he is indeed a flagrant lawbreaker. This is pretty close to premeditated. You know, we get our degrees of murder and killing somebody based on our culture, and premeditation is one of the signs. Do they have capital murder in the state? No capital murder in North Dakota? It means that you can be executed for... But capital murder is, you would get capital punishment for murder. The answer is no. Okay, well, this is tougher then. The last state I served, actually it wasn't a state, it was a republic, the Republic of Texas. In the Republic of Texas, you premeditatedly murder someone, they will send you to the prison, state prison in Huntington, and after about 20 years or so, they'll finally get around to executing you. Because if you premeditatedly murder somebody, guess what? That's a capital offense in that republic. Now, you all think Texas is a part of the United States, don't you? See, Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, they're in America. Seguin, that was in Texas. There's a big difference between those places. I just want you to know that. So in any case, actually one of my pastoral interns, my first pastoral intern, she ministers to people on death row. She has the distinction of being the closest ELCA church to the prison in Huntsville, and she will minister to people on death row down there. So it's a grim place. I mean, it's just an awful place to think about. So, oofta. So what a mess. So in any case, but they had capital murder in Egypt, just to let you know. So he murders somebody. The note that Moses looks around, we talked about that. The gratitude shown, not much there. Then Moses motors to Midian. Midian is a place in northwest Arabia, just east of the Sinai Peninsula, across the Gulf of Aqaba. But in order to get there, you need to go somewhere. Got any idea where you need to get from Egypt to Midian? You have to go through something. Just any old desert? Just any old desert? No, it's in the northwest. What's that? Go to the maps. In the back. Find yourself a handy dandy. Do we have the map book here? Let me find a good map here. That one won't do. That one just won't do. We need to find a much cooler map here. Okay, here's a good map on page, if you have your map book out, page 13, right there. Here's Midian over here, and here's Egypt over here. Midian, the what?
Sinai.
You have to go across the Sinai Desert? That's a curious place to have to go across. Geez, I wonder what possible, you know, this is a miserable desert. This is an awful thing, God, that I have to trek through this awful desert. What possible good can come from me suffering, crossing this stinking desert to flee from Pharaoh? What possible use can this be in my life? You might have to do it again. And you might have to do it again with 600,000 whining guys and the accoutrement females and children that go with them. You might have to do it again. And that's kind of funny about our lives. Sometimes we wonder, why on earth am I going through this? It doesn't make any sense. It's pure misery. It's awful. You know, yes, I'm glad. And when you're done with it, you're glad you're done with it. You say, hooray, whoo, I finished crossing the Sinai. Hallelujah. But I don't want to do that again. Well, guess what? God may have sent you through that because you may have to do that again and help a lot of other people through it. Again, it's a historical event, but there's a spiritual lesson for Moses and for us along the way that God may be bringing us through these things because we don't understand. It might be the most ridiculous, senseless suffering that you think you're going through. And yet God will bring something out of it.
I notice on the map it says the wilderness of sin.
Wilderness of sin, yes. That's simply an accident of etymology. It has nothing to do with sin as we understand it. It doesn't mean sin like we mean it, though, yes. But that's, yeah. So you got that. Yes.
Before, should have known the way, they wouldn't have to walk
If he'd been there before, he should have known the way. He wouldn't have had to wander. And he should have stopped at the gas station and asked for directions. But like all guys, he refused to ask for directions. Actually, that's an interesting point. Because the fact is that not only should have he known the way, but certainly Reuel, or Jethro. I like Jethro better. Why is he called Reuel one place and Jethro another is beyond me? But I like Jethro because of our good friend Jethro Bodine. You know, I had a Bodine family in my last congregation. Her name was Pat Bodine, and her husband's name was Skeeter. Skeeter Bodine, you got to like that. You know that you're in a congregation of characters when you've got a Skeeter Bodine and a Sparky in your congregation. Absolutely. You've got some interesting folks there, for sure. It was quite the bunch. But in any case, Gail, in answer to your question is this. It's not that they didn't know the way. They knew the way perfectly well, and making reference to the above-mentioned Sergeant Cross, who spent some of his young formative years wondering why he was over there. The Trans-Sinai Railroad, which goes across the top of the Sinai, it's just a day. It's not very far. I mean, if you have to walk it, it's not an unreasonable walk from the central highlands of Palestine to the port. What is it? I'm trying to think of the name of the place again. Ismaila? Was that it? I forget the name. There's a port. It's the southern port on the Suez Canal. I forget the name of it. It's not that far. And people say, well, what happened? Well, what happened was is that they rebelled. They didn't believe God could do it. We will take up the refrain shortly.
Did they have a pillar of smoke?
Not yet, Robert. Not yet. That was but here's what they did have. They possessed something that seems to be innate in us because of the fall. They possessed fear and doubt. When we see tough circumstances, it is our natural sinful self that expresses fear and doubt instead of seeing God's hand in it. And they express this by the phrase. Are we ready? Are we ready for the phrase yet? Are we ready for the refrain? You're going to say the refrain. Not yet, Rhonda? It's not time yet. Okay, I won't give them the refrain yet. It's too early yet. You know, don't let anything happen before it's time. But you will get to hear the refrain, so you don't want to miss. You do not want to be absent the night that we pick up the refrain, because we will say the refrain a lot, a lot. But this is kind of the hint of that. Okay, but nevertheless, Moses was doing some reconnaissance without him knowing it. Okay. All right. The next part of this thing is that we meet Reuel, who is also known as Jethro. He's got flocks, hot diggity. He's got daughters, hot diggity. And he has another name, Jethro, which is far cooler than Reuel, I think. Reuel sounds too closely to like Superman's father or something like that. That was, I don't know. It was J.L. Reuel. I don't know. What's that? Jor-El. Okay, well, close enough, as I said. Somebody was making up Hebrew names when they were writing the Superman comics. I don't know. So, in any case, that's what you have here. You have Moses sort of saying, and life's good. And life's great for him. Moses is about 40 years old at this time. We don't know that from this. We know that from what it says elsewhere in the Bible. He's about 40 years old in this time, and he kind of kicks back. And when you're 40, you know, life's, and you run into some young gal, and she's all that, and you think this is kind of neat, and you start having kids and a family, and you start settling down. You'd seen your people caring for flocks. And by the way, this guy Jethro is the priest of Midian, and Midian was one of the sons of Abraham from Keturah, so they're kind of kin. They're kind of kin. They kind of look at the world the same way that I look at the world, or that my parents looked at the world. And so this isn't so bad. I'm kind of home. This is good.
So is this the beginning of
Moses is not called by God yet, Bob. No, this is another 40-year period. And think about this. You know, you can think your life is going pretty swell. Can kick back and just kind of relax. People think it was kind of crazy that God called Abraham when he was 75 to do great stuff. That's nothing. God's going to wait until Moses is 80 before he calls him to do something absolutely incredible. But right now, he's living the dream. He's far from all his problems. He's got great wife, kids, flocks, a wise father-in-law who likes him. Nothing like a father-in-law that likes you.
Is he wealthy?
He's a priest. He's got flocks. It doesn't specifically say like it does with Abraham as wealthy, but you can kind of guess that it's the same sort of deal. If he was he certainly is a descendant of Abraham, because if he's a priest of Midian, he is that. So he probably is not unlike the others that he's dealt with there. You know, they're the same kind of people. Life's good. Life's good. I can relax. They're back in Egypt. They're back in Egypt. Now, you do kind of get the sense, there is some sort of indication that not all communication has been broken off. Not all communication has been broken off. There is some sense that they're still in contact with one another. But we don't know that. There's just kind of hints at it. We can merely speculate. Well, the clock on the wall says it's time for us to ask questions. Does anybody have any questions about tonight's, or comments, or equal time for an opposing point of view? Yes.
Let me go back to circumcision.
Back to circumcision. Just it is an event that I wish not to remember. Thank you very much.
Where did that idea come up? You think men being the leaders are the last thing that they would ever choose to identify themselves?
Sure.
Is that something that God commanded?
Okay. Now. See, this is why you needed to be present all the time. Now, I recognize that you sneak in and sort of come in. We appreciate that. We're glad you're here. I want you to know that. But had you been there for the lesson on circumcision, which was quite the fun time, those of you will recall our lesson on circumcision. It was a yabba-dabba-doo time. I got many, many 50,000-watt looks from the SMC because she thinks I was embellishing the subject too much. But the idea is this. Real briefly, the practice of circumcision is not unique to the ancient Jewish people, ancient Hebrew people. It's not unique to them. But God did say this is what we're going to do. Now, when you make a covenant, you typically cut an animal and eat that animal and have a barbecue, and that's kind of how you make a sign of the covenant. They did that, but also they wanted something to be a sign of the covenant. Now, let me just say this. There are only two occasions when the fact that a person is circumcised might be made known. One is when one is relieving oneself, and the other is when one's about to procreate, okay? Or at least practice for procreation. Let's just at least say that much. Now, then it becomes conspicuous that one is circumcised. We're all adults here, aren't we? It's conspicuous that one is circumcised at that point in time. And the conspicuousness of it at that act of procreation is a reminder, at least this is my view. I'm not requiring you to believe this. This is how I see this. That it is a reminder of the covenant that was made, and part of that covenant was that you are going to be as numerous as the stars. So in this act that you're about ready to get involved with, this is not merely a matter of your bestial desires. This is a spiritual act. A spiritual act, just as much as it is a carnal act, and it reminds you that you are doing this as a part of that covenant relationship, and that you would be doing it in a covenant relationship with someone you are in a covenant relationship with. That's why circumcision. And it would be kind of funny to do it with a big toe. Besides, you'd limp, because you need your big toe for balance. That may not be a satisfactory answer, but it's as good an answer that you're going to get out of me. Okay? I think it has to do with the fact that it is something that reminds you of who you are when you're about ready to procreate or practice procreation. It's as good as answers I can think of. Other questions? Yes, Dwayne.
Jethro.
Yes, he was.
That does not necessarily imply that he feared God.
It doesn't necessarily imply that he feared God, but you do get this sense that somewhere back in his vestigial brain, the recesses of his brain, there is some Abrahamic faith floating around back there.
Okay.
Yeah. And also when you see his wisdom, how wise is it? Because, you know, there's the great chapter where he tells Moses, you know, he pulls red-green on him. Y'all know red-green? I mean, certainly people up here know red-green. In Texas, when I said red-green, they thought I was talking about a stoplight. You know, red-green takes Harold or his nephew aside and goes, no, you're doing it all wrong, You know, that's red-green. I mean, and that's kind of what Jethro does. He takes his son-in-law and sees his son-in-law acting like a nitwit and goes, no, doing it all wrong. And he tells him how to order his judgment. It also gives us an unbelievable idea on how to order the church. If we ordered the church like Jethro ordered Israel at that time, we'd have a great church. It's called small group ministries, that people are broken down into small groups, that not everything has to go to the senior pastor. As a matter of fact, very little should go to the senior pastor. But we have smaller groups and smaller groups and smaller groups, and it works great that way. Then only the real gnarly stuff should go up the chain. But everybody thinks, of course, their event is the real gnarly stuff. Jethro's wisdom is obviously the wisdom of God.
But in general, the Midianites were not God-fearing.
Generally, no. Of course not. They were, of course, one will recall that it was the Midianites along with their friends, the Ishmaelites, and they were good friends. They were cousins, in fact, that were the ones who did what? They're the ones who profited from selling Joseph into slavery. They paid the money to their brothers. Do you think they really didn't know who those people were? Again, I've showed you the consanguinity. I've showed you how closely these people are related at the time. I've showed you that. It's crazy. Guess what? They knew who they were dealing with. They knew who they were selling. I'll bet you they made a fortune on the other end. Yes, no, their hands are not entirely clean of all this. Nevertheless. Other questions?
Obviously, the killing of babies.
The killing of babies, yeah.
You see it here, you see it in the New Testament.
Yes, you do. This is, of course, as I mentioned on Sunday, why is human life sacred? Because not because of the capacity to we think of human life in terms of our functionality, our quote quality of life, and so therefore we make decisions predicated upon that. I personally think that it is a function of our capacity to love and be loved, that we are created in the image of God emotionally, and that is what creates this in us, that is the image of God, and there is that capacity to love and be loved, and so there is a great injustice that's going on here, which is also part of the reason why God is really mad at Pharaoh. I mean, as I said before, God is mad at Pharaoh because Pharaoh thinks that he is the representation of God on earth. We've already pointed to the cross in that regard. But this is another matter. God just will not have this injustice go unchecked. Absolutely. Yeah. Other questions? Well, we come to that part of the night when I ask somebody to pray. Would somebody pray, please? Anybody? Anybody? Thank you.
I've talked a lot. I might as well talk a little bit. Heavenly Father, thank you for this time.
a blessing to others and to remember your promises to us. In your name.
Amen. Give them heaven, friends.